Today we study the death of Jesus. There is so much to cover when talking about this lesson, and I'd really prefer to take weeks and weeks to go over this, but we have one day, and it's one lesson, so that's what we're going to do. I will refer you back, though, to a couple of lessons that you'll find under NT1, New Testament Quarter 1, that talked about some of the messianic prophecies, especially the study on Isaiah and the study on Psalms. Both of those bring out Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22, which are a couple of key messianic prophecies that speak directly and exactly about Jesus' crucifixion. And when you recognize that those chapters were written well before, many years, hundreds of years before Jesus was crucified, hundreds of years before crucifixion even existed. They didn't crucify people back then. That hadn't happened until the Romans came around. When you realize that, it's just amazing, because what's described as for the death or for the punishment to the Messiah is something that had not existed at that time when those were written. People couldn't understand what was being foretold there because it just did not make sense. With crucifixion, it made complete sense. So I recommend that you go back and take a look at those lessons. Because we just really won't have time to go get into that today. So let's dive in. Let's remind ourselves, why did the Jewish leaders want to get rid of Jesus? What is it that they wanted to do and why? John 11, verse 47. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, the ruling body of the Jewish leaders. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here's this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You don't realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. Now, he didn't say that on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and to make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. So that's what they decided they needed to do, is they needed to shut him up permanently. They needed to kill him because of the risk they had with the Romans, the risk to their position. And we've talked a lot about that. Okay, they'd lose their perks. It's kind of one of the key driving forces. We talked a lot more about that last week. Well, they knew what they wanted to do to him, but they had to have a reason. They had to have an excuse. So what excuse did they come up with? What crime did Jesus commit that gave the leaders an excuse to arrest and execute him? And really, not just gave them a reason, because their reason was multifold, as we talked about last week, especially dealing with blasphemy, calling himself God, that kind of thing. But the Jewish leaders had no right, no ability to execute Jesus, but that's what they wanted to do. So they had to depend on the Romans. So they needed to have some crime to charge Jesus with to get the Romans to execute him. So what crime did he commit that gave them the reason to arrest and execute him? Matthew 26, starting at verse 59. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they couldn't find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Okay? Although they had months to plan this out, they didn't have something to charge Jesus with. They tried everything, and they brought people forward trying to find two people who would agree on something, and they couldn't come up with anything. They were trying to find some reason to that justified what it was that they were trying to do with Jesus, and that was to execute him. Well, we know that they were successful. So how did they come up with something? What crime did they finally charge Jesus with? Luke 23. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, the governor, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar, and he claims to be Christ, a king." So they threw three accusations out there at him. Okay? He's a revolutionary, subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes. Well, a lot of us do that, but they were talking about to the crowds, and we know he didn't do that. And he claims to be Christ, a king. Well, that was enough. That was the last one was the one that Pilate looked into, because someone who claims to be king could be a challenge. So he questioned Jesus, and you remember what we saw last week. He said, "Are you a king?" He goes, "Yes, I'm a king, but my kingdom is not of this world." So Pilate very quickly gets this picture of this loony guy who is out there. He may be kind of crazy, but he couldn't figure out why these people wanted to kill him. So what was Pilate's conclusion? Luke 23, starting verse 13. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence, and I found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for you see, he sent him back to us. He's done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I'll punish him, and then I'll release him." He found nothing that Jesus had done wrong. But obviously these people were so upset with Jesus, he had to do something. So he agreed to punish him. He agreed to whip him, to flog him, to satisfy these Jewish leaders. Okay? But he couldn't find any reason that deserved death. Okay? That deserved even that punishment. Well, the Jews said, "Wrong answer. That's not what we want. That's not acceptable." And we've already seen Pilate has three strikes against him with these Jewish leaderships, and he's already got word back from Tiberius the Caesar telling him to learn how to get along with these people, to be more respectful of their culture and their religious beliefs. And he's kind of teetering here. So does Pilate give in easily to the Jews when they don't accept his offer? Verse 20. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again. But they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I'll have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. Pilate tried over and over again. He tried at least three times to acquit Jesus, but he finally gave in. He finally gave in. Even though he knew he would be executing an innocent man, even though there was a bad omen with it, his wife had had nightmares about this guy and had said, "Don't have anything to do with him." And rightfully so. Here we are a couple thousand years later, and we all know who Pontius Pilate was, right? Do you know who the governor was who was there before Pilate? No. Do you know who the governor was after Pilate? No, it's because of his interaction with this man, Jesus the Christ, that we know who Pilate was. And he gave in. Why? Did he give in because he finally saw that Jesus was a threat to Caesar? Mark 15, verse 15. Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Why did he do it? Because he wanted to satisfy the crowd. Even though he was executing an innocent man, even though it was a bad omen, even though he was executing the Son of God, which he didn't know or care about, he found it more important to save his job, to save his position, to satisfy these people, to please the crowd. And again, this crowd was the Sanhedrin and their supporters. Okay? All right? Now, we talked when we reviewed that last week, we saw how he really didn't want to do this, and he really tried to get out of it, but he couldn't. He finally gave in, and he gave in largely because of, in John 19, verse 12, it says, "From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, 'If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar's. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar.'" So they kind of put him between a rock and a hard place. He knew that if he did not execute Jesus, then he was going to get in trouble with the emperor, because these guys were going to send a note to Caesar, and he's already been told no more notes, right? So he's upset with these people. They forced his hand. They forced him to execute this innocent man. So what does he post? They put signs up on top of the crosses when they execute people, saying what the person is and what they were convicted of. What did he put on that placard as Jesus' crime? John 19, verse 19. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. So everybody could read it. Aramaic was the standard everyday language of the Jews at that time. Okay? Latin was the Roman language, so all the Roman people could speak that and would read the sign there. And Greek was the world language that had spread from the Hellenization of the world by the Alexander the Great and the like. So people could typically read or speak one of those three languages. And so he put it up there in those three languages. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Now, in Latin, the Latin words are Jesus, which there's no J, it's an I. I-E-S-U-S. Jesus, Nazarenus, Rex, Eudemorium. Okay, again with an I. So, Jesus of Nazareth, King is Rex of the Jews, Judeorium. And if you abbreviate that, it's I-N-R-I. So you may have seen I-N-R-I on pulpits or someplace. That's what that is. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. That's an abbreviation for that. So that's the sign that he put up. Did anybody have any trouble with that sign? Verse 21. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, "Don't write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be King of the Jews." Okay? Yeah, they said, "He's not our king. He's not the King of the Jews. Don't put that up there." Okay? Instead, his crime is that he claimed to be King of the Jews. So, Pilate has already let into the Jews. So does he again let in and change the sign? Next verse. Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." Okay, no. They got the better of him already. He's not going any further. He's drawing the line. He's not going to change that. This is a dig that Pilate's put there. He says, "Here's your king." In fact, what we see in John 19 before that, when Pilate's about to give up, starting at verse 13, when Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat. It was the day of preparation, the Passover week, about the sixth hour. "Here's your king," Pilate said to the Jews, but they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priest answered. And then Pilate handed him over to be crucified. So you can see he's already made that position. This is your king. Okay? And he's left that sign on purpose for that, to spite them. So, Jesus was being condemned and crucified for being the King of the Jews. Now that he was guilty of being a king, was he treated like a king? Matthew 27, verse 27. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him and twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. Okay. So he received a mock coronation from the soldiers as King of the Jews. He was mocked as the King of the Jews. Now, the soldiers they have their allegiance to Rome, right? To Caesar. How do they show their allegiance to Rome and against one who might claim to be king in place of Caesar? Next verses. Verse 30. They spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. So they beat him. They spit on him. They took the staff that they had given him to act like a king and hit him on the head with it. Jesus had already been flogged, remember? We talked about that last week. They had flogged him, which means that they had ripped his back to shreds at least 39 times. He was weakening. The purpose of flogging was to weaken people so that they would die quicker. Okay. So about crucifixion, that was typically what they would do before they would crucify someone. After they would flog them, they would then walk them through town. Okay. Here in Jerusalem, there was the Via Dolorosa, which means the Way of Sorrows. And they would walk through town so that all the people would see him. Because this was the Romans saying, this is what happens to you if you rob, if you kill, if you do this, if you do that. If you break the law, this is what happens to you. So it was a great deterrent, right? So they would wind through town and end up at the place of the skull. Okay, the thought is this was a rock, a hill that had the shape of a skull. Okay, there's buildings on it now, so we can't really tell exactly. In Aramaic, place of the skull is Golgotha. In Greek, it's cranion. Okay, your cranium, the cranion. And in Latin, it's Calvaria. So when you hear Golgotha or you hear Calvary, that's talking about the place of the skull. Now, what they think is the place of the skull, this hill, was only like 18 feet high. So it's not a mountain. So there's no such thing as Mount Calvary whenever you hear that. It's just a hill. Now, as they wound through town, the soldiers in front of the criminal would carry the sign that identified the crime. That sign later would be nailed to the top of the cross so that it would be standing there, and everyone who walked by and saw the person being executed on the cross would see who it was and why they were being executed. But as they walked through town, that sign was being carried before them. The condemned person would have been first beaten to weaken the body, to speed death, because crucifixion was a very slow and painful and torturous way to die. And without a beating, it could take days and days before someone would die. By getting him close to death with the beatings, then they would die quicker. And then they would also carry their own cross through the town, okay, adding salt in the wound kind of thing, but also helping to weaken them a little bit further. Now, Jesus was kind of a special case, right? Because he really was not guilty of anything. He's the Son of God. Did his crucifixion begin any differently since he was a special case? John 19, verse 17. Carrying his own cross, he went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. Here they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side and Jesus in the middle. Nope, nothing special. Okay, he wasn't treated any differently than a common criminal. He carried the cross, he went down the Via Dolorosa, they crucified him with a couple of other common criminals. Okay, he was in great pain, but you know, he was God, right? So, since Jesus was fully God, was he able to stand up to his beatings with superhuman strength? Mark 15, verse 21. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. So some guy just happened to be walking by, coming in from out of town, from out in the country, coming into Jerusalem, and the soldiers grabbed him. The soldiers could grab anybody they wanted and make them do almost anything. And they grabbed him and told him to carry Jesus' cross. Why? Because Jesus was too weak to carry it himself. He was carrying his own cross, but they got to a point where he just couldn't do it any longer. So Simon was enlisted into service to do that. Now, something that's interesting here is that when Mark tells us this, he doesn't just tell us that some guy who was passing by was enlisted into service to carry the cross, but rather, he says it was Simon. He names a guy. Okay? He also says he was from Cyrene. Cyrene is what we know as Libya today. And it also says that he was the father of Alexander and Rufus. Okay, who cares about that trivia? Well, maybe Alexander, Rufus, and Simon did, right? But, you know, I don't think there's a lot in the Bible that isn't there for a reason. I don't think there's anything in the Bible that's in there for a reason. And the thought is that Mark wrote this gospel and sent it to the Christians, or gave it to the Christians in Rome. Well, maybe the Christians in Rome knew Simon, or at least knew Alexander and Rufus. That's kind of the thought. Well, do we know anything about Alexander and Rufus? Well, the answer to that question is maybe. Okay? We don't know if we know. Take a look at Acts 19, verse 33. Okay, and there it says, the Jews, and this is at Ephesus, the Jews pushed Alexander to the front, and some of the crowd shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. There we see an Alexander. with Paul in Ephesus. Is this Simon's son, Alexander? We don't know. Could be. Maybe not. Romans 16, verse 13. This is Paul concluding his book here to the Romans, which, again, Mark wrote his gospel to the Romans, we believe. It says, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother, who has been a mother to me too." Okay? So here we see Rufus mentioned, and is this the same Rufus? We don't know. But because he's in Rome, and he's known by Paul, and there's a Rufus that would be known by Christians in Rome that Mark wrote about, the guess is this is the same Rufus, which would mean that Rufus's mother, who was Simon's wife, got to know Paul real well, and Paul looked to her as a second mom. Okay, so, interesting. And Mark brings that out. Okay, so Jesus is on the Via Dolorosa going to Calvary, going to Golgotha, and he can't carry his cross, so Cyrene is enlisted to do that, to carry it for him. Now, did any of... So we see that maybe that had an impact on Simon, because his sons possibly became Christians. Now, did any of Jesus' followers follow in on this procession to Calvary? Luke 23, verse 27. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Okay? So a lot of people followed him. People at this time were getting up. They were waking up from their big feast the night before, the Passover feast. Or maybe they've been up for a little bit, but they're coming out of their houses, or they hear the commotion, and they go to see what's going on, and they see him. And the word spreads. And lots of people are following to see this, and women mourning and wailing for him. Does Jesus take comfort in their concern for him? Going on. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the barren women, the wombs who have never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' And then they'll say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if men do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it's dry?" He wasn't concerned about himself still. We've seen this in the last day. You know, he was more concerned about the well-being of his disciples. You know, having been with the ones that he loved, he taught them how to serve. And even though he's been going through this great despair where he sweat blood and he was in sorrow to the point of death, he still had greater concern for his disciples. Here we see, as he's on the road to his crucifixion, he can barely walk. And people are crying for him, and he says, "Don't cry for me, cry for yourselves, because I know what's going to happen to you." Okay? He quotes Hosea 10, verse 8 there, is the quote there. So why? Why did Jesus quote Hosea 10, verse 8 and tell these women that they should wish that they were childless? Well, we'll get a glimpse of it back in Matthew chapter 24, first couple of verses. Jesus left the temple and was walking away with his disciples, and they came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." Jesus foreknew that Jerusalem would be destroyed in 70 AD, about 40 years later. Some of the people in that crowd would still be around, and he's telling them, "Cry for yourselves." Okay, it'd be 40 years later, but some of them would still be around. Now, he says here about, if men do these kind of things when the trees are green, then what will happen when it's dry? That kind of refers to Ezekiel 20, verse 47. What does he mean by that? Well, let's look at John and get a little glimpse here. John 18, verse 38. "What is truth?" Pilate asked. With this, he went out again to the Jews and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him." Then 19:16, finally, Pilate handed him over to be crucified. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus. Here was an innocent man. even the head Roman at this place tried to release him and saw his innocence. That when God is around, if this can happen then, what happens when God is not there? Okay, well, we know that God's always here, but when God wasn't physically present. If the Romans crucify the innocent, well, then how are they going to treat the guilty? If the Jews are going to, Jewish leaders are going to lead to the innocent being crucified like this, then what could happen later? Okay, so he's referring to what could happen later. Okay, then they take him to Golgotha, where he's crucified. Now, crucifixion, a little bit about it, is one of the most disgraceful and cruelest forms of execution. Very tortuous. The Romans did not crucify everyone they executed. This was the worst form of execution that they did, and they reserved it for the worst kind of criminals. Escaped slaves, murderers, okay, things like that. They would never crucify a Roman citizen. Okay? That was not, that form of execution was never used on them because it was so horrible. Now there's different cross shapes that were used. Okay? The sign that we use is the lowercase T. Okay? Oftentimes it was an uppercase T, just a crossbar across the top. Sometimes it was more of a plus sign to where you didn't have the height below. The height below was as much as the height above on the crossbar. Sometimes it's on an X, okay, where the plus sign was at a diagonal. And sometimes it's on a square. Okay. Jesus would have been crucified on either a lowercase T or an uppercase T, okay, is the way that he would have been crucified. Now, what they would do is they would lay the person on the ground. They'd lay the cross on the ground, lay the person on the cross, and then nail or tie the hands and feet to the cross. Okay. They'd remove the clothes from the person and give those clothes to the guard for their service. In many places in the Roman Empire, those being crucified would just be up there naked. And that was also part of the disgrace. The Jews, that was forbidden or that was not acceptable in their religion, so Jews were allowed to wear loincloths for decency's sake. They would raise the cross, and the person would be hung by his arms and just hang there. They weren't way up in the air. Their feet were only like 1 to 2 feet off the ground. You didn't have to get them up off the ground very high. Okay, and still the same thing still happened. They would often put a wooden stake or an iron stake in the part of the cross to serve as a seat to help keep the nails from ripping through the hands. They would provide some wine drugged with gall, which is a bitter herb, a poisonous herb, but what the heck, they're dying anyway. But it helped sedate them and reduce pain, so they would offer that to those being executed. Now what happens in crucifixion is when a person's hung by the hands, the blood sinks down to the lower parts of the body. Okay, if you hold your hands up a long time, they're going to get numb, right? And that's what's happening here. Within 6 to 12 minutes, then your blood pressure drops and pulse in half and pulse rate doubles. Crucified people would die within 2 to 3 days, either by heart failure, okay, trying to pump the blood, or by asphyxiation. They couldn't breathe. They couldn't lift themselves up. They would the nail in the feet, sometimes they would have a little piece of wood underneath there that they could push themselves up with, and that allowed them to catch their breath. But as they were hanging and unable to push themselves up, they wouldn't be able to breathe and they would asphyxiate, and eventually they'd get tired enough to do that. Now, sometimes if they wanted crucifixion to the person to die quickly, they would either break the person's legs so they couldn't push themselves up any longer, or they would build a fire around them, not to burn them, but to suffocate them by the smoke. And that would bring him to death quicker. Let's take a look at Jesus' crucifixion here. Now, he came with these criminals. Was there a separate procession down the Via Dolorosa for each criminal, or were they brought to Calvary together? Luke 23, starting at verse 32. Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. They came to the place called the Skull, There they crucified him along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Okay? So all three criminals, Jesus and the other two, were taken together, went down the parade, Via Dolorosa, together, and were crucified together. Now, did Jesus get any of that pain-killing mixture that we talked about with the wine mixed with gall to make it easier to take the punishment that he was receiving? Matthew 27, verse 34. There they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. Okay, he realized what it was they were offering him, and he didn't want it. He refused it so that he would suffer the full weight of his punishment. And what is that weight? It wasn't just the flogging. It wasn't just the crucifixion. It wasn't just the desertion of his followers. His greatest pain was carrying the burdens of the world's sin on his shoulders. Okay, we've talked about this before, but think about the times when you realize that you've really hurt somebody, that you've done something wrong, or that you've sinned, and the guilt that you feel for that. And how does that make you feel? And how does that weigh you down? Add to that somebody else's. Add to that other people's. Add to that lots of people's guilt. Add to that the guilt of the whole world, and that's what Jesus was feeling. And on top of that, I heard it mentioned that for Jesus, he had not experienced guilt before, right? He had no sin, so he had no guilt. So now he was feeling not only the full weight of guilt, but he was feeling guilt for the first time. That was extremely painful for him. But yet, it wasn't in God's plan for him to go through that without feeling the pain of the world's guilt. So he refused that sedative that they offered to him. Okay? Alright, next thing we see is how Jesus felt towards the soldiers who had beaten crucified him. Luke 23, verse 34. I know we're bouncing around here between the various Gospels because they each give us a different glimpse here. And we're trying to take it in chronological order as far as how things happen. Verse 34, Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. Here we see what's known as the first word. There are seven words or seven sentences or seven times that Jesus spoke while on the cross. Here's the first. And what does he say? "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." This had to happen. People had to do this. Those crucifying him had to do it. They were ordered by Pilate. They were ordered. It was their job to kill him. They didn't know that they were killing the Son of God. Jesus asked for forgiveness for them. Okay, now I mentioned that when they crucified people, the first thing they did is they took their clothes off and gave those to the guards. Okay? Did the soldiers get Jesus' clothes or did one of his followers take them? John 19, verse 23. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, one for each of them. So there we see there were four soldiers, with the undergarment remaining. Now this garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So there were four soldiers and they divided the clothes between them. He had five clothes, right? Because there was one piece left over, his undergarment. Okay, what were those five pieces? Well, the normal wardrobe that men wore in those days is they would have an outer robe. Okay, they would have a sash, which would be tied around them. They could use that as a belt. Usually it came over their shoulder down to their waist. And the folds of that sash would serve as pockets for them. They would have some type of a headdress or a turban. They would have some sandals, okay, so there's four, and then they would have a tunic that was under the robe, and that's what's called the undergarment here, okay. Now, Jesus was extra nice. It says his garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. How could Jesus afford something like that? He couldn't, right? So somebody apparently had made this for him. It was custom made for him, woven in one piece from top to bottom to fit him, okay. So, that's way too nice to do anything with. So what did they do with Jesus' nice undergarment, and why is it important? Verse 24. "Let's not tear it," they said to one another. "Let's decide by lot who will get it." Okay, lot is throwing dice, basically. Okay, "This happened that the scripture might be fulfilled that said, 'They divided my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing.'" Okay, so what happened here? If there were five soldiers there, they wouldn't have divided, cast lots for the undergarment, would they? Okay? So here you see this fulfilled, Psalm 22:18, the fact that there were not enough soldiers, not as many soldiers as garments, and they had to throw lots for the undergarment. Now actually in Mark 15 verse 24 it says that they cast lots for all of his clothes. So maybe what they might have done is cast lots to see who got the first choice. Someone took the robe and then they threw the other remaining three cast to see who would get the next item and that kind of thing. But once they got through the four, they had the undergarment left, and so they cast lots for it. Okay, so now Jesus is on the cross. People are walking by, people are watching, people are there watching him die. What kind of sympathy does he get from the people who pass by and then recognize who he is? Matthew 27, verse 39. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you're the Son of God." So people walking by who recognized him, or at least saw the sign and saw who that was, mocked him. He told him to save himself. These are just regular people walking by. What about the Jewish leaders? Did they have any second thoughts now that they think, you know, this really was a man of God? He might be the Son of God. Okay, did they have any second thoughts there? Next verses. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said. "He can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, I'm the Son of God." Okay? So here you see the Jewish leaders mocking him. And they felt that his death really proved his blasphemy. Right? Well, who else made a point of mocking this self-proclaimed king? Next verse. Luke 23, verse 36 to 37. The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "Hey, if you're the king of the Jews, save yourself." So the soldiers mocked him. Was there anybody else who felt that Jesus should be insulted for his horrible crime of claiming to be king of the Jews? Back to Matthew 27. In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. The robbers. Okay? So people walking by mocked him. The chief priests and the leaders of the Jews mocked him. The soldiers mocked him. Even the robbers who were dying alongside of him mocked him, heaped insults on him. Not only is he bearing the full weight of the world's sin, not only is he dying, not only has he been tortured and is suffering, but all have deserted him. All have forsaken him. Okay? He's feeling the hatred of the world, the hatred of Satan through these people. What's interesting, though, is one of these people then changed and stood up for Jesus. Luke 23, verse 39. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you're under the same sentence? We're punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve. But this man, he's done nothing wrong." So one of the robbers scolded the other for insulting an innocent man, for insulting a man of God. Well, how did this robber show a surprising understanding of who Jesus really was? Verse 42, he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Now, is that about the stupidest thing you've ever heard of? Here's this robber about to die, next to a man who's about to die, and he's saying, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." All the people were expecting the Messiah to be this earthly king. There is no way Jesus is going to live through this. There's no way that robber is going to live through this. So look at the insight that that robber has. He recognizes Jesus' kingdom is not of this world. He says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Look at the great faith he has. Even though it's, how did he get this? How did he understand this? Purely by the grace of God. How do we have the faith that saves us? purely by the grace of God. For it is by grace that you're saved through faith, and that faith is not your own doing, it's the gift of God. Right? Ephesians 2, 8, 9. Well, it's a little late though. This man has had a life of crime. He's been rebellious. He's being executed for his crimes. Is it too late for this confession of faith? Verse 43. Jesus answered him, I tell you the truth. Today you will be with me in paradise. No, it's not too late. Here's proof for us that those who have strayed can still come to Jesus. It's never too late for someone to come to Jesus and be received into his kingdom, just like this robber. Jesus shows us that with his second word on the cross. Okay? I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. And we have that promise as well, that we will be with him in paradise when our time comes. Okay? All right, going on, now the Gospels tell us who all was there. And this is kind of interesting, so let's kind of jot some of this down. Matthew 27, 55 to 56, it says that many women were there watching from a distance. Okay, so there were women there watching from a distance. They weren't right there at the bottom of the cross. They were from at a distance, it says. Now, they had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's son. Okay, so Matthew gives us three of them right there. Okay, what does Mark tell us? Mark 15:40-41 says, some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph, and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Okay, so that all confirms what Matthew just told us. But Mark goes on, he says, many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. Okay, so besides those three, there were others, it says. And look at here. He kind of says that he had Mary Magdalene, which agrees. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, which agrees. And then he says Salome. So Salome then is taken to be the name of the mother of the sons of Zebedee, that is, James and John. Okay, by putting those two together, we see that was her name. Now, let's go to John. John 19, verse 25. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Now, John's listing four of them here. Okay? He's got Mary, Jesus' mom, his mom's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. The only one we see for sure in common is Mary Magdalene. So, what about Mary, the mom of James and Joseph? Well, you know, you've got another Mary here, Mary, the wife of Clopas. Okay? So is that saying that James and Joseph's father was Clopas? Could be. Could be. It also says his mother. Okay, well, neither Matthew nor Mark had mentioned his mother. But it also says his mother's sister. That's all it says. We don't know anything else about his mother's sister. Some people say that they take this and they combine it with the Mark and the Matthew verses and say that his mother's sister, Mary's sister, was Salome, that is, Zebedee's wife, that is, James and John's mother. That means James and John would have been cousins to Jesus. Okay, you see that? But we don't know that his mother's sister here in verse 25 is referring to Salome. Because remember, there Mark told us there were other women there. So, we don't know for sure, but that's if you ever hear that James and John were cousins to Jesus, that's where they get that. Okay? I've also heard it said that you can take this comma here, his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and just kind of go on saying that his mother's sister was Mary, the wife of Clopas. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense that anybody would name both of their daughters or two of their daughters Mary, right? So I don't really buy that one. I think this is talking about four people here. Okay? Now, Jesus saw these women there. Okay, now here in John it said they were near the cross of Jesus. So maybe they were at a distance and they came a little closer. Did Jesus look for comforting sympathy from these caring faces? Going on in John 19. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, dear woman, here is your son. And said to the disciple, here is your mother. From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. Okay? So here we see, rather than looking for sympathy, he gave sympathy. He showed his comforting sympathy to his grieving family, to his mother, to the disciple who felt his love the most, John. Okay? And here we have the third word from the cross. Your woman, here's your son, and here's your mother. Again, to the very end, caring more about others. Okay? All right, next we find out when all this happened. Mark 15, verse 25 says, it was the third hour when they crucified him. What does that mean? Well, the Jews counted time starting at sunup, which was around 6 o'clock, right? So the third hour would be 9 in the morning. So this points out that all of that stuff of Jesus being arrested and all the trials that happened, and even going before Pilate and Herod and then back to Pilate, all of that had to happen in time for Jesus then to be mocked, walk through the streets on the Via Dolorosa, and then be crucified by 9 in the morning. People were not out of their houses yet. People heard the commotion in the streets and came out and saw as the day went on, and people went around Jerusalem or went out to Jerusalem from whatever neighborhoods they were staying in. And you can kind of see a little map of Jerusalem on page 6. That's when they found out about it, when it was too late. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that after Jesus had been on the cross for 3 hours, God got involved. Matthew 27, verse 45. From the sixth hour, okay, which would be noon, until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. For 3 hours, the land was dark. Not just for 3 hours at dusk or at sunrise, but in the high point of the day, from 12 to 3 in the daytime, when the sun is at its highest, right? Some people say, well, maybe there was an eclipse. Well, no, because this was at Passover, and Passover happens at full moons. So there would not have been an eclipse, and it wouldn't be a 3-hour eclipse. What was it? I don't know. But I know it happened. Okay, maybe it was heavy clouds. I don't know. But we're told that the earth was dark, or at least this part of the earth here was dark, for 3 hours, from noon to 3 p.m. And then the story picks up again at 3 p.m. How did Jesus break the darkness at 3 p.m.? Next verse. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice. So he shouted, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? He says, word four, okay, his fourth word on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why would he say something like that? Well, he's carrying the whole sins of the world on his shoulders. He's removed from God. Satan has pulled out all the stops. People are mocking him. He's dying. He's been abused. He doesn't feel the presence of the Father, right? On top of that, though, there's more to it, though, than him feeling the desertion or him not feeling the presence of God. And if you look at Psalm 22, verse 1, it says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? And then this psalm goes on to describe the crucifixion of the Messiah and what happened. So I recommend you look at that sometime and maybe use those lessons I mentioned to you to guide you. But what Jesus was quoting here was Psalm 22:1, which is a psalm that people in despair would often recite. But it also was a psalm that pointed exactly to his execution, to the way that he was going to die. And he says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which is Psalm 22, verse 1. Now, we know what that means because that's what it said here. But he was saying this in Aramaic. Well, not all the people understood Aramaic. So what did those who didn't understand Aramaic think he said? Next verses. When some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest of them said, now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. Okay, when he was saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, when they heard the Eli, they thought he was saying Eliah, or Elijah. He was calling for Elijah to to come to help him. Okay? But he wasn't. Instead, we have Psalm 22, which describes Jesus' passion, his crucifixion. Now, in verse 15 of Psalm 22, it says that his mouth would be dry, dry like bone dry. Okay? How does Jesus fulfill that? John 19, verse 28. Later, knowing that all was now completed, and so that the scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I am thirsty." He says he is thirsty, and that fulfilled Psalm 22, verse 15. Okay, that's the fifth word he says on the cross. What kind of drink was he given? Next verse. A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on the stalk of the hyssop plant, and lifted it to Jesus' lips. Okay? Some wine vinegar, really some cheap wine. Okay, cheap wine that the soldiers drank because it was all they could afford. Cheap wine was made after they had already squeezed the grapes, okay, and gotten all the juice out of it and fermented that to make the good wine. They would add water to the grapes and let it soak up and then squeeze them again to try to get more out of them and ferment that. That's what this would have been, okay? That fulfilled Psalm 69, verse 21. You can look back at that on your own. All right, after he took the drink, then what did he do? Verse 30. When he had received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." With that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Okay? He said, "It is finished." The sixth word on the cross. Actually, the Greek word he said here was tetelestai. You may have heard that. Tetelestai was really a business word. When somebody had a debt and they paid the debt, they would mark that debt paid in full, or the Greek word tetelestai. Jesus said, "It's been paid in full." The great debt that mankind owed God because of our sin has now been paid in full by Jesus' death. Tetelestai. It is finished. Now that's not the very last words Jesus said. That's the last words that John tells us Jesus said, but Luke gives us a little bit more. Okay, Luke 23, verse 46. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he said this, he breathed his last. The last thing Jesus said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." He was trusting the Father throughout this. Although Jesus was God, he was also man. Is there doubt that he would come back to life? Is God really in control here? Is Jesus really going to rise? Okay? All those could be temptations that Satan could throw at him here. Satan's thrown other temptations at him before. But here you see Jesus remains trusting in his Father. "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. I'm trusting you in this." Okay? And then what happened? What happened the very moment that Jesus died? Not only has God gotten involved with the darkness here, but the darkness also shows the lack of God's presence there a little bit, right? What happens the moment Jesus dies? The earth gets involved here. Matthew 27, verse 50. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs and after Jesus' resurrection they went to the holy city and appeared to many people. Look at what happened the moment Jesus died. This temple curtain, there's a big curtain in the temple that separated the holy place from the most holy place. Nobody ever went into the most holy place except for the high priest on one day a year, on the Day of Atonement, when he went in to make atonement for the people and himself. That curtain that separated that was as thick as your hand breadth. Very heavy. Very thick. Okay? That isn't just going to rip. Unless it gets old, right? And then it might rip by its weight. But then it would rip side to side. But no, this ripped top to bottom. That doesn't happen naturally. Why did it happen? Because God made it happen. God ripped it to show us that Jesus has now opened the path to the most holy place. Opened the pathway to the Father. He is the way, the truth, and the life. No one goes to the Father but by Him. So now that's been opened. We no longer need a high priest. We no longer need priests to go to the Father for us. Rather, we have a direct path to the Father here. Jesus paved that way. You see, the earth got involved. You have an earthquake. Rocks split. Rocks. Okay? It's not that rocks fell apart from one from another, but rather they split. Okay? The dead came back to life. And enough of them to where people saw them over the coming days. Okay? What impact did this have on the people who saw it? Verse 54. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." Okay, they were terrified. The centurion and soldiers said, "Surely he was the Son of God." Okay. Luke 23, starting in verse 48. When all the people who had gathered to witness this sight saw what took place, okay, this huge reaction of the world, they beat their breasts and went away. But all those who knew him, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. The women stayed and watched, but others beat their breasts in grief, going, "Oh, I can't believe this happened," and left. Okay, grieving. Because it was clear that Jesus had died. Right? Now, if you remember, the Jews were very anxious to get Jesus dead quickly, right? We've seen that. They arrested him probably around midnight or so, and here it is, 9 in the morning, he's on a cross. This was a railroad, if you've ever seen a railroad, okay? He did this, they did this very quickly. Now they got hurried again. What hurried them this time? John 19, verse 31. Now, it was the day of preparation. Okay, what's the day of preparation? The day of preparation is the day before the Sabbath day being Saturday. So on Friday, you had to make all your preparations. And remember, days went from sundown to sundown. So like 6 o'clock at night to 6 at night. So the day of preparation, you couldn't do any work. You couldn't cook meals or any of that on the Sabbath day. So you had to do all of that on the day of preparation so that you could remain clean on the day of Sabbath. This was Friday. It was the day of preparation. And the next day was to be a special Sabbath. Not just any Sabbath, but this is the Sabbath that belonged to Passover week, or the week of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it was a special Sabbath. Because the Jews did not want the bodies left on crosses during the Sabbath, they asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies taken down. They wanted the bodies off the cross, okay, before the Sabbath. They wanted the bodies in the tomb, taken off the crosses before night so that the Sabbath would remain clean for everyone who dealt with this. Well, why not just leave them on the cross and then deal with them on Sunday when the Sabbath was over? We'll turn to Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 22. If a man guilty of a capital offense is put to death and his body is hung on a tree, you must not leave his body on the tree overnight. Be sure to bury him that same day, because anyone who's hung on a tree is under God's curse. You must not desecrate the land that your Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Okay? So God had given a command that bodies must not be left hanging overnight. So they went to Pilate. Okay? We need to kill these guys need to die so that their bodies can come off of the crosses before sundown. Well, when the soldiers went to break the legs of these people, what did they find? And who saw them find it? John 19, verse 32. The soldiers therefore came and broke the legs of the first man who had been crucified with Jesus, and then those of the other. Now, why did they break the legs? Remember, with their legs broken, they wouldn't be able to push themselves up, wouldn't be able to catch their breath. They would then suffocate to death. Wouldn't be able to breathe. But when they came to Jesus and found that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Instead, one of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear, bringing a sudden flow of blood and water. The man who saw it has given testimony, and his testimony is true. He knows that he tells the truth, and he testifies so that you also may believe. In other words, John is saying here in verse 35, I saw it, and I'm telling you this is the truth. Okay? So they broke the other two guys, but Jesus had already died. So to make sure, rather than breaking his legs, he was pierced. Okay? They ran a sword into him. Why was it important that his legs weren't broken? Verse 36, these things happened so that the scripture would be fulfilled, not one of his bones will be broken. And, as another scripture says, they will look on the one they have pierced. So it fulfilled a number of messianic prophecies. Okay, Exodus 12:46, Numbers 9:12, and Psalm 34:20, and Zechariah 12:10 deal with are the prophecies that were fulfilled. The first three dealing with none of his bones being broken, and the last one being about the one that was pierced. Okay. Now, what's interesting is when blood and water came out, that showed that his heart and the sac around that, the pericardium, which carries a water-like fluid, both had been pierced by the sword. Some say that what it shows is that his heart had burst and had gone into his pericardium, so that when the sword was punched in, you've got the pericardium and then the blood's already in there from the heart. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been that much blood from just in the heart. The thing about him, his heart bursting, is it burst under his heart truly broke under the weight of the sin of the world, is what that's saying there. The other note of all this is that with his heart and pericardium pierced, he is completely dead. Anybody who says that Jesus recovered in the tomb doesn't understand that you cannot recover when your heart has been punched through with a spear and you've lost your blood and you've lost the pericardium and all that. Okay? So it's showing us that Jesus is fully dead. It's also showing us that it fulfilled numerous Old Testament prophecies. Now, what's this thing about the bones being broken? What's important about that? Well, let's read a couple of verses here. Let's read the Exodus 12:43-47. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "These are the regulations for the Passover. No foreigners to eat of it. Any slave you have bought may eat of it after you've circumcised him, but a temporary resident and a hired worker may not eat of it. Now, it must be eaten inside one house. Take none of the meat outside the house. Do not break any of the bones. The whole community of Israel must celebrate it." Okay, so when God put down the rules for the Passover, one of the key things out of these few rules is don't break any bones of the lamb. Numbers 9, starting at verse 9. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Tell the Israelites, when you or your descendants are unclean because of a dead body or are away on a journey, they may still celebrate the Lord's Passover. They are to celebrate it on the 14th day of the second month at twilight. They are to eat the lamb together with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. They must not leave any of it until morning or break any of its bones. When they celebrate the Passover, they must follow all of the regulations.'" Okay, there we see it again. The bones of the Passover lamb were not to be broken. What was Jesus but the Lamb of God? We see Jesus called the Lamb of God many places. He was the Paschal Lamb. That means the Passover Lamb. Rather than sacrificing a lamb every Passover now, each year, Jesus was the Passover Lamb, the great sacrifice once and for all. All those little lambs that were sacrificed at Passovers before Jesus came as the great Paschal Lamb were just a foreview of the great Paschal Lamb that Jesus was. Okay? None of his bones were broken following the regulations of the Passover, right? Okay, so Jesus has died. He's on the cross. They take his body off. Now, people didn't all have tombs back then. If you had money, you could have a tomb, and they could bury you in the ground. Or if you had a lot of money, maybe you had a cave or a family cave that your family would be buried in. Those caves would have different shelves in them that you would lay a body, and over time, those bodies would degrade, and you would go in and take the bones that were left over and put them in a bone box, an ossuary, and you would have ossuaries in that cave, and that would free up that shelf for someone else to be laid there. Okay, but for poor people and for criminals, the bodies were usually thrown out in the trash heap in the Valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, and burned. Well, Jesus wasn't burned. His body was not thrown on the trash heap like the other criminals likely were. Why not? Because it was buried. Who took charge of that? Who buried him? Matthew 27, verse 57. "As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea, named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him." So a guy named Joseph, okay, He was a rich man from Arimathea. Arimathea was a town about 20 miles northwest of Jerusalem. He obviously didn't come 20 miles for this, but rather he was there for the Passover, right? He's a rich man, and he himself had become a disciple of Jesus, it says there. Now Luke tells us a little bit more about Joseph. Luke 23, starting at verse 50. Now there was a man named Joseph, a member of the council, a good and upright man who had not consented to their decision and action. He came from the Judean town of Arimathea and was waiting for the kingdom of God. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body. That's it. Okay. Here we see Joseph was a council member, a member of the Sanhedrin. He was one of these Jewish leaders. He would have been in that meeting of the Sanhedrin, you would think. Okay. But he didn't speak up for Jesus. Remember, there were members of the Sanhedrin who were disciples of Jesus, but they wouldn't say anything because they didn't want to get cast out of the synagogue. He was a council member. In the Mark version, it says that he was a prominent council member. So it wasn't just one of the 70. He was one of the main guys. He was good and upright. You see that he disagreed with the decision and the action. Okay. He longed for the coming of the Messiah. And he wondered, apparently, whether Jesus might be that Messiah. He believed. He was a disciple here. So, he asked for the body. How did Pilate respond to Joseph's request? Well, let's look at the Mark version. It tells us a little bit more. Mark 15, starting at verse 43. Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate, of course, and asked for Jesus' body. That's very bold because this is at risk of his position. He could be kicked out of the Sanhedrin for this. He could be kicked out of the synagogue for this and be shunned by all the Jews. Pilate was surprised to hear that Jesus was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. Okay? He was surprised that Jesus had already died. You know, he had given the order for the legs to be broken, but still, it would still take some time for these men to suffocate to death, to die. Jesus was already dead. So he gave the body to Joseph. Did anyone help Joseph? Go back to John 19, verse 38. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jews. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who had earlier visited Jesus at night, early in Jesus' ministry, that we also have the story in John 3, I believe. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. It's pretty heavy, okay? He brought a lot of myrrh and aloes, some spices. Okay, John 3, 1 to 21, that's where you'll find the story of Nicodemus. He was the member of the Sanhedrin who had come to Jesus at night before and said, "We know that you're from God because no one could do the kind of things that you do unless he were from God." So Joseph and Nicodemus took Jesus' body, and what did they do with it? Verse 40. Taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with the spices in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. At the place where Jesus was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. Because it was the Jewish day of preparation, and since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. So they took Jesus' body and they gave it the normal Jewish burial treatment. They took this myrrh and aloe, 75 pounds of it, and put it all over his body and wrapped it in strips of linen. Okay, kind of almost like a mummy. This was not the Egyptian mummification process. But myrrh and the spices there would keep the smell down a little bit too, as part of the reason for that. But they would wrap the body in linen. And you see, they put it in an unused tomb. Well, a tomb happened to be nearby, so they did that. Well, how were they able to find an unoccupied tomb on such short notice? Well, for one thing, it was nearby, right? But there's a bigger reason. Matthew 27, verse 59. Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. How did he know where to find a new unused tomb that he could use and not be bothered? Because it was his. He had made it. It was brand new, never been used. It had been cut out of the rock. This wasn't just a cave that existed and they kind of fashioned it out to be a tomb. Cutting through rock manually, which is the way they did it back then, was very expensive. This was a very expensive tomb that Joseph had there. It was a tomb he had built for himself. And he put Jesus in it. And it says then he went away. Now if Joseph and Nicodemus were the only ones there, how did the disciples know where Jesus was buried? Luke 23, verse 55. The women who had come with Jesus from Galilee followed Joseph and saw the tomb and how his body was laid in it. Okay? So the women saw it. The women saw where they laid Jesus. Okay? Now, the women would have wanted to add their own spices. That's part of the mourning processes. They would have wanted to treat the body themselves. Why didn't they do that the next day? Next verse. Then they went home and prepared spices and perfumes. So, okay, you see they're preparing them. But they rested on the Sabbath in obedience to the commandment. It was against God's regulations to travel that far and to touch a dead body on the Sabbath. So they were going to wait until the day after the Sabbath, the Sunday. Where were Jesus' apostles all during this time? Okay, we keep hearing about the women. What about his apostles? John 20, verse 10. Then the disciples went back to their homes. Okay? They went home. The women were the ones who were going to take care of the body. The women were the ones who watched what happened. The men were afraid and hid. The women refrained from working on the Sabbath by going and treating the body. What about the Jewish leaders? Did they refrain from work on the Sabbath, especially since this was a special Sabbath, or did they have some business to conduct? Matthew 27, verse 62. The next day, the one after the preparation day. Okay, yeah, that's the Sabbath day, right? The chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. So that would have made them walk further than was allowed for the Sabbath day. It also put them in contact with a Gentile, which was just unheard of on the Sabbath day. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I'll rise again. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples might come and steal the body and tell the people that he's been raised from the dead. This last deception would be worse than the first. So they went to Pilate and asked him to secure the tomb. They were more concerned about that than they were about keeping the Sabbath. So did Pilate agree and personally take care of getting the tomb secured? Next verse. Take a guard, Pilate answered, and you go and make the tomb as secure as you know how. Okay? No, he didn't take responsibility for it. He said, you go do it. He left it in their hands. So did the leaders then ask Pilate to do it so that they wouldn't have to work on the Sabbath? Next verse. So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. No. They, again, weren't concerned about keeping the Sabbath or anything else. They were concerned about making sure this guy didn't come back alive here, or at least the disciples didn't say that he did. So they sealed it. And it said they put a seal on it, which would have been a cord that they would have put on both the stretch across the stone that covered up the entrance to the cave and secured it with clay on each side. And that would show if anybody ever tampered with it. Okay? They also did it themselves. They did all this themselves because they wanted to protect their positions at any cost. They didn't want this to come back and haunt them. Jesus is in the tomb. What happens next? Well, we'll talk about that. Next week, we won't have class because of Easter, but the following week, we'll look at the Easter story. We'll look at what happened on that Easter Sunday. We'll look what happened next. Let's pray. God, our Father, boy, you have shown us so much. You've revealed to us all the horrible things that Jesus went through as he died on our behalf. You know, we've talked about this. We've heard this story so many times that we often take it for granted, and we don't really realize the great suffering and pain that he went through, the great thing that he did on our behalf, the great weight of the world's sins that he carried for us. We ask you, as we continue to go into this Passion Week, the week of Easter, that we remember what it was that Jesus did on our behalf, the great cost to Him. And it was all done out of Your love, all done purely out of Your grace, for we certainly don't deserve it. We thank and praise You for the great gift of grace that You give us through Your Son, Jesus Christ, who died on our behalf. In His name we pray. Amen.